So, good evening. I'm exceedingly pleased to be here. I teach at one of these East Coast fancy-dancy universities, but I will tell you that I am a very proud alumnus of another Big Ten university, and that is the University of Minnesota. And I believe that what that university did for me is, in fact, what it is going to do for many of the students, for all the students in this room. The University of Minnesota, I came from a rural town of 1,000 people, and my high school class had 44 members. And I went to a university that had 60,000 students. It was four times the size of a county in which I grew up. And people said to me, oh, you're going to be lost. Of course, I was very happy to be lost because I was so tired of being known as, oh, you're Harold Butler's son. That is, everybody knew who you were in a town of 1,000 people, and I loved being at a place where no one knew who I was. But what did I find? I found a faculty who cared about what I did. I found courses that were totally compelling to me. I loved it so much I stayed, and that's where I did my PhD as well. And so I'm a big believer and a big supporter of big public American universities, and I am deeply proud to be here tonight. I want to really discuss the subject of our lecture, The Surprise of Religion in Modern America. And I want to begin actually with the story that appeared in the USA Today, which I only read as I was standing waiting for my plane at O'Hare Airport. It was in the box, you know, how the USA Today newspapers are there. And unfortunately, there were about 25 people in line to buy newspapers, and I didn't feel like I should steal it, but I admit I was tempted, because it isn't every day that, you know, you look at a USA Today, and here's a story on your whole subject matter, and the story was about the decline of religion in modern America, that is, in religion in our current situation. And so I didn't get to read it, but I certainly decided, well, when I get home, I'm going to look this up on the web. And then I did a very nice radio broadcast at the University of Illinois radio station this morning, and the excellent inquisitor actually handed me the press release about this story. And I want to begin with it, because it actually is a story from Trinity College in Hartford, which has a center for the study of American religion. And it actually, the point is that doing a public opinion survey of 50,000 some respondents, which is very interesting. I will admit I don't quite understand that, why they needed that many respondents, but part of it is to get deep data so they can do it by group and they can do it by state. And so I'm sure that's why they did it. They actually document in this story somewhat of a decline in religious affiliation and interest. But this is where I want to begin, because it's a decline. We have to remember what it's a decline from. And what it's a decline from is very high figures for religious affiliation, and that's with a very loose understanding of what we mean by religious affiliation. It doesn't mean that you actually signed a card, but it means that you might attend a religious congregation at some point of any kind. It means that in a public opinion survey you say, yes, I'm religious, and America is famous for being quite different than Scandinavia. For example, when Americans answer Gallup poll questions on am I religious, do I believe in God, 98% to 99% of all Americans will say yes. In Scandinavia, it's usually 30% to 40% will say yes. Another 30-40% say, well, I'm not sure, and another 30% say, absolutely not, I have no interest in that. So we are a somewhat different kind of culture. And this recent poll done out of Trinity College suggests that our numbers are off a little bit, meaning that they've declined to the 70th percentile or the 80th percentile, and that we have a new mix. We have more secularists, but they still only account for 15% of the people who respond to these kinds of surveys. And so the point that I would make is not so much that our public commitment to overt religious belief or activity has really declined and has slipped as far off the radar screen as I regret to say our economy is slipping off the radar screen, making everybody here, me and you, nervous. Okay? So, and I'm not actually here to tout any of this. I'm simply trying to point out that we have an issue, an intellectual issue in thinking about religion in modern America, by which I mean America in the 20th century. Okay? So I want to get into a whole discussion about what modernity means, but I'll just take modern to be the 20th century America. It means urban America, it means industrial America, it means a bureaucratic America, it means an America that is not a land of a face-to-face society in the kind of towns that I grew up in. It means people grow up in places in which they actually don't know most of the people who belong there. And the question is, in this society, in this kind of a society, what happens to religion? And why are we even discussing this? In other words, think of it this way. Many observers in the 1890s, so let's go back a century, a little bit more than a century, would really have been surprised to have heard the kind of commentary on the 2008 presidential election in which a minister served for 6 weeks, 8 weeks as a principal focus for dialogue about who should be the Democratic nominee for president and who should be the president of the United States. And many observers from the 1880s and 90s would have been surprised to know that the evangelical vote in the United States was viewed as a critical issue by the Republican Party in both 2004 and 2000. And the same observers would be equally surprised to know that in 1992, and this is a pretty well-established fact, although I will grant there may be political scientists in this group that who may challenge me on this, is that one of the two or three major reasons that Bill Clinton is believed to have defeated the first President Bush was that he ate into the evangelical vote that Bush had. And the question is whether Clinton claimed it or Bush lost it is another critical issue. In the late 1990s, when the French socialist leader Lionel Jospin ran for president in France, many French voters did not know that Jospin was a Protestant, what in other lingo is called a Huguenot, Huguenot. They didn't know that. But in America, at the end of the 20th century, in the beginning of the 21st century, religion plays a vital role in the way we think about our society and the way we think about our politics. So let's go back a century and ask, isn't this surprising? I've been going to tell you it was surprising to the New York Times and most, the Chicago Tribune, and most big newspapers in the mid and early and mid-1990s who were having increasingly to explain the phenomena of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson in American politics. And that reflects a certain point of view. It actually reflects, in an odd way and not a direct way, concerns that both intellectuals and religious leaders had a century earlier. We were to go back to the 1890s. I'm a historian, okay? So we want to go back to the 1890s and think, how did many Americans and how did religious leaders and how did intellectual leaders think about the future of religion in modern society? Most, but not all, would have made the following argument that they really don't know the answer to that question, and in fact, the nature of modernity as they have so far experienced it in the 19th century, the rise of industrialism, the eclipse of the small village, the rise of science and its challenge to religious explanations for the nature of the world, the growing bureaucratization of society, the anonymity of society, questioned the future of religion, because religion had been founded in an earlier, as they conceived it, in an earlier time in which the Bible, however you want to define that, the Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, or the Christian Bible, add the New Testament to that, presupposed a certain kind of world that didn't necessarily take account of modern science. because industrialism and urbanization together were wiping away the kind of society in which men and women had traditionally experienced religion, which was primarily a face-to-face society, in which men and women can see and learn what do other people think in our village. Who is a doubter? Who is an atheist? Who is the village atheist? Who is attending regularly? Who is not attending? What are their social patterns? Who is committing adultery? Who is having sexual relationships with individuals that they shouldn't have sexual relationships with? Who is a thief? And they all know that. And if we doubt that, read the literature of every American denomination from the 1840s up to 1900 and past that. And every one of them will be filled with virtual terror about the future of religion in this society. What are Protestants, what are Presbyterians going to do with the city? How are they going to manage? Well, how are they going to deal with the rise of massive lower class populations? How are they going to manage the middle class who are interested in theories about religion espoused by figures like Darwin? How are they going to explain the fact that the world is not 5,000 years old, the world may be 5 billion years old, and maybe, in fact, human beings are at the end of a long chain of creation that somehow only the most elusive interpretation of the book of Genesis would allow believers to accept that. Because the book of Genesis, as certainly traditionally explained, accepts the idea that God created mankind whole. And what if that's not true? And so religious leaders were worried about the intellectual world they were now involved in, about the intellectual world they might be in, that might further erode their beliefs. They're mystified by how to deal with massive populations. They don't know what to do. In addition, they're all worried about religious diversity in America. And so there's a special American character to this problem that might not necessarily be a problem in Copenhagen or in Paris or in Berlin. And that is, Protestants were worried deeply. No longer were Congregationalists worried about Presbyterians. They were actually worried, well, they'll accept the idea, well, we're all called Protestants together, but we're deeply worried about massive growth in the American Catholic population. And the Catholic Church, by the 1870s, there are historians trace this somewhat differently, but they used to be thought maybe by the 1830s, but it's probably true, by the 1870s, it was the largest single religious denomination in the United States. How did that fit with our Puritan heritage, our Protestant heritage? But Catholics were worried, immigrant Catholics were worried about a church that no longer looked just German, or no longer just looked like Southern Italians, or no longer was just Polish Catholics. Now everyone was here. And what do we do about parishes in which Catholics don't share the same basic language? And then they all had to deal with the Irish hierarchy in the Roman Catholic Church. Then Jews. Jews are migrating to America in large numbers from the 1880s forward. There have been Jews present since the 1650s, but in very small numbers. 1880s forward, and coming out of Eastern Europe, eager to be free of the legal, social, and frankly sometimes physical repression of Judaism. But what did America open up for Jews as well as for Catholics? Just as it was opening up for Protestants, it opened up freedom, and that freedom could be intellectual freedom and theological freedom as well as personal freedom. And so what happened if Jews became communists? What happened if Jews became Marxists? What happened if Catholics became communists and Marxists and didn't in the American freedom that opened so many doors? So that the denominational leaders were oftentimes all seemingly intellectually paralyzed by the fact that in the 1880s and 90s, the world was opening up a religious future that was very doubtful. And the question is, why were their fears in some regards not realized? In other words, what happened in our experience that led America to a different kind of pattern? a pattern that makes religion as vital in American life in 2009 as it was in 1909, because I'm going to make the following argument here, and that is that we may be a more religious society, a more religious committed society in 2009, despite the slippage possibly explored in the Trinity College polls, than we were in 1909. And in fact, we were more committed to a variety of expressions, a more circumscribed variety of expressions, in 1909 than we were in 1809. What should we know about this? Historians love to do very many things, but spend lots of time in the library. And if I were to take you to the Yale Divinity School Library, which contains our biggest set of denominational records, what could I point out to you? We could go to the Presbyterian records, we could go to congregational records, we could point out and open any of them. And what will they contain? One of the things they'll contain are numbers. American denominational leaders of all sorts love to count, and they counted church members from the 1760s forward. So Baptists begin counting in the 1760s, and they've saved their record. And how do they count? They don't just say, how many members do we have in this congregation? Let me explain to you how they did this. We're very sophisticated even in the 1760s. They would make someone from our statistics departments very happy. They counted who was a current member, who had been disciplined in the congregation, who had been expelled from the congregation, who had been dismissed from the congregation by letter. What did that mean? Notice the little trick that's going on. Dismissed by letter. That means that the individual was moving to another area where there was a Baptist congregation, and they took a letter with them saying they were a member in good standing, and they presented this letter to the next congregation they were moving to. Right? Then they also counted who had been added to their congregation by letter. In other words, who had come into their own congregation by letter. Okay? So what do we have here? We have already a very sophisticated understanding of who to count, how we're counting them, that it takes account of motion, famous American geographical mobility. They're not paralyzed. They're not stuck on a single idea of what membership means. They understand that the world is fluid and they're already dealing with it. Well, by the 1810s and 20s, all the denominations agree, and that's what you're going to find if we go up to the University of Chicago libraries, if we look at denominational records that I know are in the University of Illinois library, you find numbers all over the place. What do we know? Some very simple facts. That at the time of the American Revolution, among European descended Americans, because we cannot count Africans in this count because denomination didn't actually on the eve of the American Revolution did not allow them to join most congregations. Okay, so we wouldn't want to include them statistically or numerically in our count. That about 20% of adults in the United States belong to some kind of religious organization. That number moves up to about 35% into the antebellum period. That is the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. It's going to creep up after the Civil War into the 40% level, but it doesn't go above 50%. We're really quite sure about this. Then in the 1920s and 30s, it's going to fall because, ironically, during the disillusionment of the post-World War I era and the American Depression, rather than turning toward denominations and belonging, actually people pulled back a little bit, in part very clearly because they couldn't afford to belong. And they felt too sheepish to go to services where they couldn't support their denomination. When do we, then comes the post-World War II period. So we say, America's going to remake its whole population. People are going to move to the suburbs. Think of some, surely there are some of you here from the Chicago suburbs. And what happens in these suburbs? Look at the buildings. If you're from the Chicago suburbs, think of all the religious congregations that are in your suburb. When were those buildings built? Well, I can tell you they're built from 1946 to 1955 or 56. Every denomination had an amazing plan to develop the suburbs. Religiously, they were better than the shopping center developers. Okay? So they organized, they did financial plans, they worked with banks to provide loans to congregations to construct very nice buildings. So architectural historians usually don't think too much of the architecture of the post-World War II period, but I won't go into that. So they were very serviceable buildings. What does this mean? It means that for every trip to the shopping center, okay, for every trip to Northbrook, people made 2, 3, and 4 trips to their suburban congregation. And what did they do in these congregations? Among other things, they also received marriage counseling. Think of it this way. There was a group for infants. There was a group for younger children. There was a group for teenagers. There was a group for unmarried young adults. There was a group for young married adults. There was a group for parents. There was a group for older parents. And there's a group for senior citizens. Okay, so at least 8 different kinds of groups in almost, and so we could go to Roman Catholic congregations. We could look at Protestant congregations. We can look at synagogues. We're going to find very similar kinds of patterns. So what's happening here? Among the things that's happening is that the denominations marketed themselves very assiduously and very cleverly. Some people say they actually commercialized themselves. Now, I make the argument that if that's true, the commercialization of American religion from the 1910s and 20s, the Easter Parade, much criticism by many denominational leaders of the Easter Parade in New York City and Philadelphia. So a more sober analysis, I think, would also suggest that the Easter Parade also put religion forward as something that was valuable, something that was interesting, something that actually attracted attention, even when clergy were very suspicious of the event. The proliferation of Christmas as a holiday, the development of Hanukkah among American Jews, in response both to certain kinds of commercial ventures, made religion more feasible. It attracted adherents rather than pushed them away, even when clergy of many varieties were very suspicious of these kinds of events. So they didn't want Xmas. So Methodist ministers, I can assure you, in the 1950s, didn't like it when their parishioners had wreaths, commercial wreaths with lights, and it said Xmas. With Xmas, of course, it's hard to put on a small wreath, it's hard to put Christmas on the whole wreath, so X was, that was a good substitute. They didn't like X, even though that was a standard abbreviation for Christian. So they didn't care for that. What's happening here? Religion in America is becoming, as we move from the 1910s and 20s into the post-World War II period, is becoming less denominational. In other words, it's less important after the Second World War to be a Presbyterian, to be a Methodist, to be a Roman Catholic, or to be a specific kind of Jew, that is, an Orthodox Jew, a conservative Jew with a capital C, there's a denomination, many of you will know, conservative Judaism, or a Reformed Jew, than it is simply to be Jewish, or to be Christian, or to be Catholic in the general. Catholics lag a little bit behind in this development. It was important to be religious. And the great symbol of that, and the a great exponent of it, was President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was often ridiculed for a very insightful thing he said in December of 1952, after the election, 1952 presidential election was over, but before he was inaugurated. He had a press conference in New York City, and he famously said, well, America needs a religion, and I don't care what it is. Okay? So oftentimes Eisenhower was denigrated for saying that. But what he actually was reflecting, the idea that there's something about the idea of religion that's good, and in fact, he didn't necessarily care how you were religious. Now, Eisenhower, of course, was a famous World War II commander. And where would he have gotten this idea? Well, one of the places that he would have gotten this idea was from all the Harvard-trained, and many chaplains in the Second World War were trained at Harvard in a very short course, in which they were given pamphlets on why are we fighting this war? And why would they be concerned about that? Well, army commanders in the Second World War believed they knew 2 things. One, this was going to be a really tough war. It was not going to be a war they were going to win easily, just like that, as in fact happened sort of for Americans, at least in the First World War II. And secondly, what did they know about the American population? They knew that if there were divisions among men, and we're talking mostly about a male armed force here, that what were they afraid of? They were afraid of two kinds of things, ethnic divisions and religious divisions among soldiers. And how could America overcome racial issues? How could America overcome ethnic issues of ethnic tension? How could America overcome religious divisions? Remember, we're still living in a society with healthy, regrettably, healthy anti-Catholicism, healthy anti-Semitism, and tensions even among some varieties of Protestants. How was this going to be molded into a force? The idea was is that we are fighting a war for democracy. And what is democracy founded in? It's founded in the common religion we have. And what do Protestants, Catholics, and Jews all share? They share a belief in the same God who is the founder of democracy, and their beliefs are essentially similar. So Eisenhower's idea about, perhaps too casually expressed, about America needs a religion and I don't care what it is, reflected in fact this theological program. Millions of pamphlets were distributed to American soldiers in the Second World War espousing this kind of notion. Now, it didn't always work out so great. And so, if you in the field and in practice, so if you read one of the great, several great novels of the Second World War, which is Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, okay? So I'm a believer in 200-page books, and regrettably, Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead is about a 500-page novel, so I won't recommend that you rush right out to the Illini bookstore and get it. I don't even know if it's stocked anymore. It's actually a pretty good novel, but if you were to take a look at the first 100 pages, how does Mailer, a fairly secular man who was raised as a Jew in Brooklyn, how does he characterize his army unit in the vaguely in the Pacific, because that's what the novel is about. It's about Japanese-American tension, fighting over the same island. He measures each individual. Remember, this is done by a Brooklyn Jew, all right? So he measures each individual. He describes them, and he hinges the character of each on their religion. So there's a deeply believing Catholic who also has had affairs with other women. He's very guilty about that. There's a secular Jew. There's a more believing Jew. There's a fundamentalist Protestant. And if you were to go and you sketch out each one of the characters in the novel, every character is primarily identified by their religion. And there's huge tension. Now, in the novel, they resolve all their tension over their hatred. It's not a particularly enlivening and ethically and morally upstanding viewpoint, but how do the characters resolve all those tensions? They resolve them, regrettably, in their hatred of the Japanese. So that's what the novel is about. It's about how all of this gets resolved in many regards in their literal hatred of the Japanese. But the novel is interesting because of the attention Mailer paid to the religious character of the cast in the novel. So we move from denominational identity as being important to American Catholics, American Jews, American Protestants in 1870, 1900, 1910, 1915, to something that happens in the course of the period from 1930 to 1960, in which simply being religious is more important. And then you get the identification of religion with values. Religion isn't so much doctrine after the Second World War as it's values. And what does that lead to? It leads to, what is the underlying focus and the underlying instrument of the civil rights crusade of the 1950s? My friends in the historical profession sometimes pay a little bit more attention to Martin Luther King's secular activities and whatnot than to his religious background. He was, you will remember, a Baptist preacher. And he ended his famous I Have a Dream speech with a hymn. Free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. And you cannot, you ask, why is it that the Ku Klux Klan burned congregations, buildings, in African-American buildings in the South in the 1950s and 60s? Because they were the center of civil rights voter registration. They did it both for the symbol and for the fact. And we wouldn't have had the kind of participation among white Americans were it not for a wide variety among Protestants, Catholics, and Jews of liberal clergy and liberal, largely liberal parishioners who moved into the South in the 1950s and 60s. And then there's the rise of the new Christian right, and we wouldn't have the kind of politics that we have in America still in 2009 if it weren't for Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And whatever one's views of Martin Luther King or whatever one's views of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, each of them hinged their activities on their understanding of what religion called them to do. And each of them will justify what they're doing on open religious grounds. It's absolutely true, of course, that the Civil Rights Crusade has a secular character, and it's completely true that the right in America had a section of it only vaguely committed to religion. So there's a part of that that is very much secular. But there's a huge religious part here. And so what you have, the surprise of religion in the 20th century, is that it changes, and it could be criticized for this, it changes its focus on doctrine and denominational identity in major ways as we move through the 20th century and moves to a kind of religiosity that's very much committed to personal attainment as well as community building, and is a different kind of religion than might necessarily have been the case earlier. Those earlier dimensions were not entirely missing by any means from the American Catholic experience in the 1890s and 1900s. So the great American, I believe, excellent American Catholic historian, John McGreevy, who's now the dean of the Liberal Arts College at Notre Dame, has formerly been its history chairman there, wrote a wonderful book on, it's called Parish Boundaries, in which he described how in the 1890s, 1900, 1910, How did Catholic immigrants define themselves? They would define themselves by the parish into which they would ultimately belong. And this happened even among Italian immigrants who oftentimes were deeply anti-clerical. Why were they deeply anti-clerical? Because the papacy had opposed vigorously the reunification of Italy for political reasons. And so there was great lay resistance to the Catholic clergy in southern Italy particularly, but throughout Italy in general. There was a lot of criticism. But the Italian immigrant clergy, as well as resident bishops in America and resident local leaders, learned that if they wanted, that how could they attract parishioners? By using the parish as an instrument of community building. In fact, using the parish as an instrument of community building for migrants. It's where the migrants would learn English. It's where they would receive social services. It's where they would learn how to deal with City Hall. It's where they would understand how the city works. And the priests or the nuns would explain to them all of these facets of modern American life, the life that was confusing to them. And the same thing would happen to Polish immigrants, the same thing would happen to German Catholic immigrants. In rural Minnesota and Wisconsin, the denominations change virtually overnight. They have to get rid of their idea about state church Lutheranism, and they fissure. So Lutherans come from Scandinavia in the main, belonging to the state churches. By 1900, there are more than 30 different Scandinavian denominations in Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin alone. And they just split out along some different doctrinal lines, some different theological lines, but mainly on the differences on who has the most energetic clergy, who has the most vital clergy, which minister is most successful. And then in the 1920s and 30s, then they all merge again. So then they slowly build back together, usually separating on denominational lines. And by the 1950s or 60s, we really have three or four major Lutheran denominations. And so we've sort of put the pie back together in a sense, but certainly not in the way that it ever looked in Sweden, Norway, or Denmark. Absolutely doesn't look like that at all. And so you put it together. But mainly it has to do with finding a way to build communities. And then overall, something else occurs, and that is the development of what something I'm going to call therapeutic theology. That is, theologies that begin more to address questions of individual success and failure, individual comprehension of the world, than doctrine. And all seminaries in America, Catholic seminaries a little bit behind Protestant and Jewish seminaries, began to develop a curricula that emphasizes counseling. So we historians have a kind of macabre joke about that, that we like historians, you know, but we have a joke that's saying, oh yes, all the seminaries ditched their historians for courses in pastoral counseling. And so they really got rid of a number of historians because they really wanted people who were doing pastoral counseling. And so there will be a book forthcoming from Harvard Press in a year, I think, in which is going to explain that if you want to add up where did Americans receive marriage counseling, meaning counseling before young people are married or counseling after they are married, between about 1935 and 1970, the answer to that question comes from clergy, more than it comes from secular psychologists and psychiatrists. Because the clergy were trained in this, and whatever be the extent of their training and however one wants to think about it, they absorbed this into their seminaries, and then this is what was done. So a young couple wanting to be married by a minister typically will then undergo counseling. It might be two sessions, three sessions. But some of the counseling was sort of interesting because a number of the clergy actually began to use tests. They would use compatibility tests. And so they had each of the man and the woman would take these tests. Do you have shared interest? Do you both like baseball? Do you cook together? Do you have these kinds of interests? And then they say, oh, I don't know about, because you're not really sharing common interests here. Or if there's some difficulty, they're in a marriage that has difficulty, we say, well, no wonder there's some difficulty because you don't share any interests at all. And so it's a wonder, how did you get married? So then the minister has to deal with this, what's going to happen to divorce at a time when divorce rates, of course, are going up. And so so the great exemplar of that, of course, is the famous 1952 book published by Norman Vincent Peale called The Power of Positive Thinking. And The Power of Positive Thinking was a book that sold millions of copies, so I dare say that I assure that there must be Salvation Army or Goodwill bookstores in Champaign-Urbana, right? So typically you can go to most any of them and you'll still find copies of The Power of Positive Thinking. It sold literally millions and millions of copies, is actually true. And it was really an explanation of how to succeed in the world, using religion as a kind of commonplace understanding of Protestantism and ethics and morals to do this. But we often, so Norman Vincent Peale is widely ridiculed, I think in many, if I may say, religious studies departments and history departments, sort of a silly book, not one you should take seriously. But ask a different question. Why was it so popular? And what was the payoff for it? So I'm going to suggest to you that less attention needs to be paid in that book to the words positive thinking, and more attention needs to be paid to the second word of the title, power. What did he address in this, Peale address in this book? The modern conceit that we can shape the world. So as modern women, we actually believe it probably quite deeply, more than you may realize, that we can actually shape the world in which we live. The Puritan theologian Jonathan Edwards, I don't believe myself, actually believed that you could shape the world in which you live, so much as he believed that religion helped explain the world in which we live and would, in fact, explain some of its features. But the idea that he could write a book that would explain how to succeed in life in general is not my understanding of Edwards. So modern religion becomes therapeutic in character. It helps men and women get through tough times. It's going to deal with community. And these are some of the factors that help us explain why it is when we come down to the 1980s and 90s, religion is not only still around, it is around in very powerful ways in our society. It could be that it has lost its way. It could be that it shouldn't have taken these paths. But these are some of the paths that explain why it is that religion is a surprise, why it is that it's still here, and why it's here somewhat uniquely in the West, in such public forms, in ways that most observers would tell you are not true of modern Europe, for example. So if we go to modern Scandinavia, if we go to modern Britain, if we go to modern France, if we go to Italy, increasingly actually to Ireland, and even more recently somewhat to Poland, and I'll explain why I'm making special references to Ireland and Poland. In Britain, in Scandinavia, in France, let's take Paris. Usually, Japanese tourists outnumber French worshippers at Notre Dame every Sunday. And if we were to go to Westminster Cathedral, you just have to hunt up the Brits, because what is the level of church attendance in Great Britain in 2009? It generally runs around 9%, around 5% of the public will attend maybe once in 6 months, twice a year at the most. In the United States, that's going to run somewhere around 50 to 60%. In Scandinavia, the figures are equally low. They're no better in Germany, and they're surprisingly no better in France or in Italy on weekly attendance. There is an upsurge on Easter for nominal Catholics in both Italy and in France, but the figures are generally pretty low. But in America, the figures are really remarkable. And I suspect that most people in this room understand that, because it's part, typically, of most everybody's experience. So one of the things that European tourists oftentimes are really puzzled about, they wonder, no, really, do Americans actually go to church? Okay? And that means, so let's say, church, synagogue, and now mosque. And the answer to that is, generally speaking, fairly overwhelmingly yes. It's still yes in 2009, despite the downturn that the Trinity poll just released may suggest. But it's still enormously higher than is true in Europe, and it's far, far greater than anyone would ever have suggested in the 1880s and 1890s. They couldn't have begun to imagine this kind of a vital future for religion in modern America at the end of the 20th century. So how do we get here? Let me suggest, let me summarize by some explanations. There are two kinds of transformations that occur. One of them is the great attention to community building that begins in the 19th century and becomes an exceedingly important focus for American religious experience in the 20th century. There's the second transformation is the rise of this theology that I'm going to call therapeutic theology. And despite all the attention, for example, to doctrine among conservative Protestant groups, what is the feature of the megachurch, the modern megachurch that gets so much attention? In fact, huge array of social services in most megachurch congregations. So they're performing many kinds of services for their congregants, even while they're maintaining, as they say, a doctrinal purity. I think there's also the second point. So there are two kinds of transformations. The second point I'd make is the power of institutional authority and institutional creativity in America. The denominations in America have been exceedingly skilled at figuring out how to maneuver in American society. And historians don't pay nearly as much attention as they should to denominational structure, to the exercise of authority within denominations, to the way denominations work. If you ask the question which I raised earlier, how on earth did all these denominations succeed so wonderfully, well, let's put it that way, numerically, wonderfully, in the American suburbs after, as they developed from 1946 to about 1955 or 56, it comes through assiduous denominational planning of the most astounding kind. They really at least matched American industry in figuring out how to deal with the suburbs. They easily match the shopping center creators, and in fact, they may be doing still better than the shopping center creators, because in many, I'm from Minnesota, okay, so what's happening in Minnesota? Some of the shopping centers are failing, because they can't sustain themselves. They're having less success over the last 4 or 5 years than the congregations are having. The congregations are still there in the suburbs, but some of the shopping centers are failing. I think there's something that I didn't touch on, but I'm going to mention because I think it has a peculiar force, and that is anti-communism in the post-World War II period, 1948 and 49 into the 1960s. Many, but not all, of the denominations hinged a good deal of their rhetoric on anti-communism because communism was godless, and America stood for God, and that was important. But I think that's a very special kind of thing. But the last factor that I would say is if there is a long-term explanation for this, it is the power of the effects of the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution ratified in the 1790s. And if you know the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution, the last 16 words deal, the first part of the amendment deals with free speech, and the second part of the amendment deals with religion. And there are 16 very powerful words. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof. The separation of organized religion from the state freed the denominations to organize on their own. And there is no doubt that in 1788, 89, 90, 91, when this kind of idea was being proposed, first in Virginia and then elsewhere, there was a great deal of nervousness. The president of my university, Yale University, Ezra Stiles, a famous president of Yale, was actually deeply worried about this new amendment because he couldn't imagine, as a New England Puritan, how he could live in a society where government didn't support religion. So in the First Amendment, as it was originally conceived, it only applied to the new federal government. And Connecticut kept its establishment until 1818, and Massachusetts until 1834, I think. So they didn't give up for long, but it was a very weak establishment. So what happens? Think of this. So I'll really be the historian and go take us way back, not to modern America, but to Methodists on the eve of the American Revolution withdrew all of their missionaries. They had barely begun to organize in America because the Wesleys were Tories. So the Wesleys were supported the crown. They were deep believers in the crown. They pulled all their missionaries out of America. They hadn't yet achieved very much success. And only Francis Asbury stayed. After the Revolution, the Methodists bear the stigma of being Tories, you know, as does the Church of England. And, you know, this isn't a good thing to be a Methodist and say, oh, yeah, well, of course, I didn't support the American Revolution, but I've got the answer for religion. Well, this is not a good way to proselytize. By 1830, the largest single Protestant denomination in America and the largest denomination in America was the Methodist Church. And the Methodist Church not only succeeded by the earlier force that I suggested, deft institutional planning and the extraordinary use of their own institutional structure, but they also succeeded because they were free to organize as they wished. And they took advantage of that in terms of fundraising, in terms of developing their techniques, in terms of proselytizing. They did it on their own. They didn't have to report to the state. And that, I believe, accounts in the end for the tremendous proliferation of religious groups and religious affiliation in America. That all of these groups could do it on their own. They could actually succeed on their own. They didn't need the permission of the state. And if there's a part of the federal constitution and its amendments that has changed the nature of American society, and whose effects are still felt profoundly in the 20th century, then it's the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution. It is an idea that's come in for some criticism really recently, the idea of the separation of church and state. Because all of these denominations are free to organize as they wish, and they all succeeded in ways far beyond the efforts and the ability of even their own founders in America to comprehend that. Think of America and the number of new religious groups that have been created in America, from the Mormons to spiritualism in the 19th century that sort of faded, to the Millerite movement, to Seventh-day Adventism, to Christian Science, to a movement called New Thought in the 20th century, to Father Divine. We come up in the late 20th century to L. Ron Hubbard and the creation of Scientology. And I'm going to tell you there are still new groups being, some group in America is sitting in a different room tonight planning the creation of a new religious group. And that this is simply not the history of Great Britain. It's not the history at the same level of France. It's not the history of Denmark. It's not the history of most European societies. And I'm going to make the argument that in this case, a good part of our 20th century history is explained by an 18th century phenomenon. And the first time that any Western society had ever separated religion from the state. And this, in part, these factors explain the surprise of religion in 2009. I don't want to hear to say that it's good. I'm a historian, so I'm not going to hear say that it's good. I'm simply saying to figure out who we are and what we do, we have to understand not only the presence of religion in our own society, but how it is that it came to be. And it came to be through discrete events of the 20th century, but some of them stretch all the way back to the end of the colonial period, and that is to the First Amendment of the Federal Constitution. We live in a society that is, in this regard, markedly different from most of our Western European competitors. We actually look more like some, but not all, so-called third world countries, minus China and minus Japan. Okay? And that's a unique American achievement, and it's something that I think I find as a scholar and as a historian very much fun to trace. I thank you very much.